today's episode of Myeloma Crowd Radio, a show that connects patients with myeloma researchers. I'm your host, Jenny Alstrom. We'd like to thank today's episode sponsor, Takeda Oncology, for their support of Myeloma Crowd Radio and all that they do for myeloma patients. Now, our show today is with one of myeloma's true great doctors and researchers in the field. Dr. Kenneth Anderson has made a remarkable impact over the course of his 40-year career in helping bring new study and treatment options to the clinic, and we look forward to his giving us a very broad perspective of where we've been and where we are going in the field of myeloma. So, Dr. Anderson, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much, Jenny, for all you're doing with this show and helping patients really keep apprised of all the wonderful developments in myeloma.
Well, there are so many, and we're going to talk about those. But before we get started, let me just give an introduction for you, if people are not familiar with you, and they should be. Dr. Kenneth Anderson is the Kraft Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, as well as Director of the LeBeau Institute for Myeloma Therapeutics and the Jerome Lipper Multiple Myeloma Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He is a Doris Duke Distinguished Clinical Research Scientist and American Cancer Society Clinical Research Professor. After graduating from Johns Hopkins, he trained in internal medicine and then completed hematology, medical oncology, and tumor immunology training at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Over the last three decades, he has focused his laboratory and clinical research studies on myeloma and has developed laboratory and animal models of the tumor in its microenvironment, which have identified and validated new target therapies that have quickly moved into clinical trials, culminating in FDA approval. His paradigm for identifying and validating targets in the tumor cell has transformed myeloma therapy and dramatically improved patient outcomes. He is the winner of many awards, including the International Myeloma Workshop Waldenstrom's Award, the IMF Robert Kyle Lifetime Achievement Award, the American Association for Cancer Research Joseph Bricknell Award, the American Society of Hematology William Damashek Prize, the Johns Hopkins Society of Scholars, election to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science and the Royal College of Physicians and Pathologists in the UK, the ASCO David Karnofsky Award, the Hope Funds for Cancer Research Award of Excellence in Clinical Research, the Ron Burton Humanitarian Award, the Harvard Medical School Warren Alpert Foundation Prize, the American Cancer Society Medal of Honor, the Leonard Zakim Patient Advocacy Award, the Samuel Waxman Research Foundation David Workman Memorial Award, and the University of Miami Sylvester Cancer Center Annual Zubrod Memorial Award. He has served as president of the International Myeloma Society and as president-elect of the American Society of Hematology. So we are just absolutely thrilled and delighted that you're joining us today. So thank you very much again for joining.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, in your role at the American Society of Hematology and as past editor of their medical journal, you have kind of a general's or a leadership role about how myeloma research and treatment fits into hematology and cancer in general. So maybe you can give us a broad perspective, because in myeloma, so much has happened, and it's really an example for other types of cancers. So what does the myeloma experience teach the world in general in oncology?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point, Jenny. Multiple myeloma, as everyone knows, is a bone marrow cancer. So it's a blood cancer, not unlike leukemia and lymphoma. I start with that because it's easy to obtain the tumor cells from the bone marrow, and it's relatively speaking easy to study in terms of the biology, not only of the tumor cells themselves, which are readily attainable, but also to study the tumor cells in model systems of the bone marrow where they actually grow in patients. And so what myeloma is example of, or for in one sense, is the microenvironment, the importance of the nurturing bone marrow for the growth, survival, and drug resistance of the tumor cell. The second issue is not only the biology, but that, in fact, one can exploit this interaction between the tumor cell and the neighborhood in which it grows for treatment purposes and have targets that not only directly kill the tumor cell but interrupt its interaction with the bone marrow or even cut off nurturing cytokines or other factors that promote the tumor cell growth and resistance. It's also a model for what importance the cells in the neighborhood play, both in promoting tumor cell growth, but also potentially suppressing the immune system, which we may talk about later. So it's a model of getting cells from patients, bringing them to the laboratory, making model systems both in the laboratory and animals that allow us to understand how the tumor grows and, more importantly, to understand how to interfere with that growth in a meaningful way with clinical implications. The other thing that I think myeloma is a wonderful example of is the collaboration between lots of different members of the team in order to get these new observations from the bench to the bedside, clinical trials, and ultimately new treatments. And what I mean by the collaboration is there are investigators, both clinical and basic and academia. There are biotech and pharmaceuticals. There are the funders of research, whether they be the National Cancer Institute or foundations. There are the advocacy groups. There are, importantly, the regulators, the FDA and others, but most importantly, the patients who are really the heroes and inspiration for this team. But my point would be that when all of these constituencies work together, we can rapidly have progress. The evidence for that is 16 new FDA-approved treatments in the last 12 years, including 7 new treatments in 2015. And that's just an incredible track record. And obviously, patients are doing much, much better, living 3 to 4 times longer now as a direct result. So I think the examples for other cancers would be the ability to study the actual patient tumor cells and derive critical information from those studies. And secondly, the importance of collaborative efforts as a myeloma community. And when one all pull in the right direction, we really can make progress very rapidly.
Okay, that's a great summary. And I have noticed that there's wonderful collaboration between the researchers and everyone involved. And there's a lot of enthusiasm, too, that it seems like more and more people are weighing in, but maybe that's just my perception. On the reverse side, are there any new trends in oncology that would help make new advances in the world of myeloma?
Yes, I think there are. The one really and arguably most exciting area in oncology now are the immune therapies. The excitement probably is very recent, but the idea of trying to stimulate a patient's immune system to recognize and reject their own cancer is not a new idea. It's just been very frustrating to do so for many decades. But I think myeloma is now benefiting from the work that was really initially shown in solid tumors, for example, melanoma and lung cancer, whereby checkpoint inhibitors, the so-called PD-1 camouflage on an immune cell, reacting with something called PD-L1, a camouflage on the myeloma cell, the PD-1, PD-L1 interaction, therefore, or circuit being a break on the immune system, can actually be broken now with antibodies to PD-1 on one hand or antibodies to PD-L1 to take the brakes off of the immune system and allow the patient's own immune cells to react against their cancer. This has been pioneered in mice and now has really translated to wonderful advances in human cancer, and in particular in melanoma, lung cancer, and other solid tumors. Early data from many laboratories, including ours, and early clinical trials are now showing the importance of, if you will, checkpoint inhibitors in terms of allowing the immune response to occur. So that's one very important message or learning that we've had from others. Another example I might quickly mention is in the genomic analysis. Clearly, myeloma has had extensive genomic analyses in and of itself. So have some of the other cancers, solid tumors. But where we can learn, for example, would be in melanoma, the skin cancer, there's a mutation called V600E, BRAF, B-R-A-F, in those patients. And there's a medicine called venurafimib that can be used, and these patients do very well with the medicine that targets this mutation. What we learned in myeloma from our colleagues in melanoma is when we found the same abnormality in myeloma cells, we can borrow the same medicine from them and, in fact, achieve some benefit. So we, I think, have been blessed in myeloma. We've been sort of a model system for, as I mentioned a minute ago, for the microenvironment, for the ability to study the tumor cell, including genomics, and for the collaborative efforts. And on the other hand, we've learned from our colleagues in solid tumors, because oftentimes the mechanisms, the circuits that allow those solid tumor cells to grow and survive and resist drugs, or the abnormalities in those circuits, so-called mutations or other abnormalities that either prolong it, the tumor cell growth, or don't allow it to die like it should, those abnormalities are common across many cancers. And as a consequence, if the mechanisms are the same, we can borrow and fast-forward progress on the treatment side as well. So it's a back and forth, if you will, process, and it can't help but fast-forward progress in both areas as a result.
And I love the idea of borrowing a medicine that might already be through that FDA approval process, saving you a lot of time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, before we move on to the bone marrow microenvironment, because that's where I want to ask the questions next, let me just ask you about the checkpoint inhibitors. I know at ASH, the checkpoint, there was a lot of excitement around the checkpoint inhibitors, but when I was reading the papers, it seemed like some of the results were like 30%, response rates and things. So I was kind of wanting to understand more about why they were so exciting, although I know they are exciting. So it's just my lack of knowledge about what makes them so exciting.
I think what makes them so exciting is, as I alluded to a minute ago, or introduced anyway, is that for the first time, there's an ability to allow the patient's own immune cells, which already are stimulated, to recognize and react against the tumor. There's now, for the first time, a way to allow them to be functional and actually reject their cancer cells. I guess I would just back up for 1 minute and say, in the immune area, there are multiple potential treatments. Checkpoint inhibitors are one, but let me mention that we in myeloma have now multiple ways of, if you will, overcoming the immune suppression in patients. Those of you who are patients will know that as a consequence of your myeloma, the immune system is really not working as efficiently as it should. We call it immunocompromised, and as a result, you're more susceptible to infections and other complications. Well, some of the drugs we use are able to restore that Achilles heel or that immunosuppression and allow the immune system to do function much better. The immunomodulatory drugs, lenalidomide, pomalidomide, and others, work in part by stimulating the patient's immune system to react against their own myeloma. We've recently had monoclonal antibodies daratumumab and elotuzumab FDA approved. And those are a second class of immune therapies. They are given by vein. They go in and recognize a fingerprint proteins on myeloma cells, bind to them, and allow the patient's own immune system to reject their own myeloma. A third class of immune therapies are what you mentioned, Jenny, the checkpoint inhibitors. And as I'll just review, there's PD-L1, this camouflage on the myeloma cell, and there's this coating on the immune cell called PD-1. And when those two things interact, PD-L1 and PD-1, there's a break on the immune system. And now with antibodies against PD-1 or PD-L1, medicines which are antibodies against either of those two can sort of blow the fuse on that interaction, take the brakes off the immune system, and allow it to work. The fourth immune strategy, besides the IMiDs, the Revlimid and pomalidomide, and the second one being the antibodies, and the third one the checkpoint inhibitors, the fourth one are the vaccines. And there's real excitement in myeloma nowadays because we can vaccinate patients against their own myeloma. We can get immune responses, which then can be amplified or turned up by using Revlimid or by using the checkpoint inhibitors or by using either one. And wouldn't it be a really happy day if we could get an immune response that would be long-lasting and what we call memory immune response, so that each and every time a patient's myeloma tried to return, the immune response would recognize it and prevent that from happening. And that's really special. The immune side is special also because it's very potent and very selective, and it's very adaptable. We all get a cold today and we get better, and tomorrow we get an earache and we get better. It's because the immune system is so adaptable. And finally, there are, as a fifth kind of immune therapies, there are these CAR T cells that many of you may have heard about. And in plain English, those are taking cells, immune cells from the blood of patients outside of the body, expanding them after teaching them or programming them to recognize a particular fingerprint protein on the myeloma cell. So take the immune cells from patients outside the body, program them to recognize their own myeloma, grow them up in large numbers, and then simply transfuse them back as their own immune army against their own myeloma. That's called CAR T cells. But why I say all of these different five categories is that I think in the future we'll be using combinations of immune approaches, just like we started many decades ago with combination of conventional chemotherapy, and more recently we've had combination of targeted treatments, Revlimid, Velcade, etc. Now what I'm talking about is combinations of immune therapies. And already at the American Society of Hematology, we had combinations of lenalidomide and checkpoint inhibitors, lenalidomide and monoclonal antibodies, lenalidomide and vaccines. But you will see more and more combination therapy. And again, the holy grail of achieving a reaction, an immune response in patients that is called a memory response against their own cancer would be a really special advance, and you can see it coming with combined immune approaches.
Well, I love the idea of letting the immune system do its job and eliminating the things that are from the myeloma that are causing it to either shut down or be inhibited. And so I love the multi-step approach. And I know with the complexity of myeloma, that's very likely to have these combined immune approaches. That would be amazing. Well, let's talk for just a minute about the microenvironment research, because you really pioneered this field of understanding the bone marrow microenvironment, what's happening to support the growth of myeloma. Could you give us an idea about how your thinking has been changed or what you've learned about that bone marrow microenvironment and how to target it?
Surely, it's more. My thinking has been, more affirmed or strengthened in terms of the importance of the microenvironment. As I mentioned at the outset, the ability to understand what it is in the bone marrow that is nurturing for myeloma cells, allowing them to grow, survive, and resist drugs, has allowed us and others to interrupt those processes. Now, as the years have gone by, there are multiple favorable factors in the bone marrow. Some of them are other cells, something called plasmacytoid dendritic cells, or another cell called the myeloid-derived suppressor cell. The names are not particularly important, but those cells are our enemy because, on the one hand, they support the myeloma cell growth, survival, and drug resistance. And on the other hand, they suppress the patient's immune system. So when we develop treatments now, we can target these accessory cells and, on the one hand, inhibit myeloma cell growth, and on the other hand, restore immune function. So I think that it's never been more true than it is today that the microenvironment is critical. I will just cite that, you know, experiments that are now from the early 1980s really demonstrated that drugs can work in isolation against either patient myeloma cells or myeloma cell-derived lines. However, if you bind them or put them in the presence of bone marrow stromal cells, you can completely attenuate or abrogate the ability of the drugs to work. Dexamethasone is a good example for commonly used to treat myeloma. Completely abrogated, does not work at all in the microenvironment. So when you develop systems and then you screen drugs and you understand how things, what mechanisms are in place in the bone marrow microenvironment, then you can interfere with those things. And that's really helped a lot in terms of the progress of myeloma. Obviously, the immune cells are part of the microenvironment as well. And I've just described many different ways that we're targeting the immune system. So I think there's never been more emphasis on events in the microenvironment that are tumor-promoting, and there's lots of efforts now, therapies directed at trying to correct what's wrong in the microenvironment.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier about BRAF, and I know like BRAF and NRAS and KRAS are all very specific. I don't know if those are specific to the bone marrow microenvironment, but I know that in 2013, I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about those targets in a lung cancer, like you were mentioning, and how has that kind of evolved over the last few years now that we're in 2015? Are those BRAF and other targets still equally applicable?
Yes, I think certainly the initial genomic analyses in solid tumors and in multiple myeloma as well have been held up with time. The problem in multiple myeloma in particular is that there are many abnormalities. Firstly, there are many kinds of myeloma, but within that context, there are many genetic abnormalities right from the outset at the time of diagnosis. And even further than more, as a confounding problem, as the disease progresses, further genomic abnormalities occur, underlying ultimately the myeloma relapsing or returning. Now, the molecule you mentioned, the BRAF, is part of a pathway that mediates tumor cell growth. That's true in melanoma, it's true in lung cancer, and it's true in myeloma as well. So that's true. It can be turned on with a switch stuck in the on position by a mutation. It can be turned on by myeloma cells just binding to the bone marrow. It can be turned on by factors such as interleukin-6 that help the myeloma cell grow. But that biology, which is not new any longer, has held up. The issue comes that as the genomic studies become more and more sophisticated, the number of abnormalities that we're finding really is honestly somewhat daunting. It tells, on the one hand, that we need to absolutely use combinations of treatments to treat the abnormalities such as BRAF and others that we know about at the outset, but also add in drugs to try to anticipate the escape routes that myeloma might use to allow a relapse of disease. It's a little bit like the infectious disease model of tuberculosis or HIV and others, where we can use combinations of approaches and to not only treat but avoid resistance. The second trend that this analogy teaches us is to go as early as possible, so take the most effective treatments and use them earlier and earlier, you know, newly diagnosed, maybe even in smoldering multiple myeloma. But again, I think that the genetic analysis ongoing in myeloma, there are many analyses that are happening. The MMRC and MMRF have an extensive COMPASS trial. There are analyses ongoing in the U.S. at some of the major medical centers, this included, and in Europe. But all of us are finding that there is tremendous heterogeneity and complexity in multiple myeloma. As I say, it's somewhat daunting. The one thing I will tell you, though, is that in myeloma, when you find these genetic abnormalities, we can sometimes capitalize on the vulnerabilities that they really program into the cancer cell. Let me be very plain about that. So myeloma cells have, for example, overexpression of a gene called c-myc, M-Y-C, and it causes them, especially a subset of myeloma, to grow very, very rapidly. As a consequence, they're under huge stress because of this rapid proliferation, and they activate what's called a stress response. What we and others have shown is if you can block that stress response with medicines, you can overwhelm the ability of the myeloma cell to deal with the stress, and it dies. Another example I'll mention to you is a recent observation that since these myeloma cells have so much genetic damage, so the original observations held up, but what I'm trying to describe is as more and more studies are done, there's additional and much more complex genetic abnormality than we might have anticipated. So why is it with all this gene damage the myeloma cells don't die like they should if they have all this damage? And we have recently been studying and shown that there's a, if you will, a fuse in the natural death circuit, which would otherwise result in the death of these cells with all the gene damage. It's missing. And if we can replace that fuse with a medicine, then these cells that are stressed out because of all the genomic abnormalities would die a natural death. So the genetics, on the one hand, can tell us, well, we'll try to use combinations of medicines. But the other implication I'm trying to describe is because of the genetic abnormalities, there's vulnerabilities, there's weaknesses, there's Achilles heels, I call them, that we can attack and sort of turn the myeloma cell against itself.
Well, perfect. I mean, it sounds like you have multiple strategies. You're trying to make sure that because it's so complex and there's such a big variety that, number one, you don't miss anything. Number two, you get it early before it has time to mutate in sort of a devilish way. And then, just like you said, you know, use it to turn it against itself. Well, we talked a little bit about this before we started the show, but with all the good news coming out of the most recent ASCO/ASH meetings, everyone's very, very excited, and I think everyone has cause to be very grateful to people like you who are making these things happen. And but also, are there specific issues where you share the optimism, and also where would you be cautious, I guess?
Yeah, so I think everyone should be very excited, palpably excited about the progress in myeloma. There's never been better treatment options or more treatment options than there are today. So overwhelmingly positive. I think the ability to use target protein degradation with the proteasome inhibitors, bortezomib, carfilzomib, now Ninlaro, the ability with the immunomodulatory drugs to target cells and also stimulate the immune system with lenalidomide and pomalidomide, the antibodies, elotuzumab and daratumumab, as I mentioned earlier, to target the cells, label them, and allow the immune system then to reject them, the HDAC inhibitor, panobinostat, to, if you will, especially together with the proteasome inhibitor, block protein degradation. Never has there been a more exciting time. So that's all to the good, and I think it is directly the reason that patients with multiple myeloma are living on average 3 to 4 times longer, and we have many patients who have lived many decades. My longest complete responder in myeloma is from 1983. So we have a lot of people now doing extraordinarily well. So that's all to the good. I do want to, though, acknowledge and be absolutely realistic. We are still privileged to see patients quite a lot at our center. And in spite of all these medicines, we still have myeloma returning and resistant, et cetera. I think that that is sort of a call to action. I think our job isn't done. I think the wonderful collaborative efforts that we've had, especially over the last 15 to 20 years, need to continue. And I do think there are extraordinary opportunities. I mentioned the immune area. I think the genomics to sort of point us at which are the right vulnerabilities we need to target would be my two favorite areas. But the opportunities are extraordinary for future progress. So this just reminds me to say, you know, that patients are the reason that all this progress happened, because patients were willing to be the heroes and go on clinical trials and try new medicines. I will share with you, I'm privileged to take care of the first patient that ever went on Revlimid for multiple myeloma, and he's still on it 15 years later. And, you know, that is, you need to be, in my opinion, courageous and honestly inspirational to say that you're willing to try a medicine that no one's tried before, and that is going on day in and day out in the myeloma community, trying new medicines, new combinations, and back and forth from the clinic where patients are willing to do this, back to the laboratory where mechanisms are being understood for why medicines work or not. That to and fro, bench and bedside and back, it's called translational research. But that's really what's happened. And anyway, I'm very excited. On the one hand, people are clearly living longer, having milestones with their families, and it's just such an honor and privilege to get to know patients and their families and celebrate these successes together. On the other hand, we are more obsessed, quite frankly, than ever, because we're getting closer and closer. It's a chronic illness now, but we are quite obsessed to really do even better still. So much optimism, but still work to be done.
Well, we're glad that you're obsessed. And this series was started as because we wanted to encourage patients to participate in clinical trials. If you think about getting people to participate and then having that accelerate the pace of research, we could really double down on the pace of research if more people would participate in the clinical trials. And I know a lot of people who aren't familiar with the clinical trial aspect think, well, I don't know, should I do it or should I not? But what you're typically comparing in myeloma is the standard of care versus something even better.
Yeah, no, I think clinical trials, you know, it is said that a minority of patients, perhaps 5% or fewer of patients participate in clinical trials. In the distant past, it used to be that new drugs that came along that were going to be used in clinical trials, and often in the case of patients whose cancer had returned many times, these drugs were not as promising as we have in myeloma over the last 15 to 20 years. To say that more directly, you know, Velcade, Revlimid, the very first patients treated with these agents responded. This was life-saving phase one early clinical trials. So I want to emphasize that I think nowadays, especially in multiple myeloma, when drugs make it to clinical trials, they are very promising. They've made it through many preclinical tests and screening, and they have been selected to be effective. And we in myeloma maybe are spoiled, but when we talk about this new clinical trial, we expect these drugs to work and these combinations to work. I think the other thing is that the clinical care that patients receive on when they're on a clinical trial is extraordinary. It's not only standard of care, often it's much more, because genetic analyses are done, immune analyses are done, or special testing is done, much more in the way of imaging or other tests than otherwise would be done. And so I think it's good for the patients themselves to go on to clinical trials. It's obviously good for all of us as a community, because that's the way we improve the standard of care. So really want to encourage people to participate. I think in some of the myeloma centers, it's really the percentage of participation is way up high. I know at our center it's probably in the range of 500 patients go on protocol each year. And it is the reason. I just want to highlight that we as a community have been able to make the progress we have.
Well, I agree, and I would encourage patients to consider clinical trials, and there are some new tools. I know Spark Cures is one of those that helps patients find clinical trials easier and make sense, and we really encourage that. Now, another question. I know at ASH they talked, there was a lot of anticipation understanding the IFM study from the French group about the role of transplants. So you see all these new drugs come out, and you think, wow, could we avoid transplant at some point? What advice, I guess, would you give a patient considering a transplant today, and how do you see the use of transplant projecting that out into the future? Because I know it sounded like transplant was still a very core treatment.
Yeah, no, this is a very burning issue in multiple myeloma. The trial that you refer to, where we're actually part of here, the IFM is the French National Myeloma Group, and the other part of that is Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, leading, honestly, multiple institutions in this country who are participating in these trials. But the basic observation that was presented at the American Society of Hematology is the patients received Revlimid, Velcade, dexamethasone. They then had all of their stem cells collected in a randomized way. Half of the patients went on to get an early high-dose melphalan stem cell transplant, followed by 1 year of lenalidomide maintenance. The other half of patients had additional courses of RVD and then lenalidomide maintenance for 1 year, saving the transplant for later. What this study showed was that those patients who had the lenalidomide Velcade dex stem cell collection went early to high-dose melphalan transplant, followed by 1 year of maintenance of lenalidomide, had a progression-free survival or time without active myeloma advantage of about 9 months. At least as of this time, there was no overall survival advantage. It did demonstrate that minimal residual disease, that is getting fewer than, or getting a response, if you will, that's very major, fewer than one myeloma cell in 1 million normal bone marrow cells, was more commonly achieved with the transplant. And if it was achieved either by the transplant or after maintenance, it portended for a much better outcome. And the third thing it showed, besides the transplant prolonging progression-free survival and more commonly achieving MRD negativity, is that sequencing, looking at the genes in the myeloma cell, rather than studying the phenotype by immunofluorescence, the sequencing seemed to be more sensitive at picking up residual myeloma. Anyway, so based on this particular finding, it did support the use of stem cell transplant, and so we still think that's a standard of care. In the United States, we have a very parallel trial that's almost finished, led by Paul Richardson here. It's the same trial, except maintenance with lenalidomide is continued until progression. I mentioned earlier I've had a patient on lenalidomide for 15 years. Many patients in the post-transplant setting, in North America at least, are on continuing treatment. And this trial started in 2009, and as we said, it's comparing transplant or not, everybody getting maintenance, and it's still ongoing, almost finished. But I mention that because what it tells you is, in the setting of continuous maintenance, there can't be major differences between the transplant arm and the non-transplant arm. If there were, the study would have been interrupted. Either way, whether the transplant did better or not, these studies are monitored carefully. So what it tells you is both groups, the people who got the transplant and those who did not, must be doing extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. In any event, over time, we'll figure this out together as a community. I personally think that ultimately when we have combinations, maybe it'll be four drugs classes, maybe it will be five, but probably over time the transplant will may not be necessary. For now, at least with a one-year maintenance, what the French trial showed was, as I mentioned, you know, more time without active myeloma, more likely to get MRD negativity, and probably the best way to measure MRD is by looking at the gene sequencing. But I would ask patients to stay tuned because there's many more studies to come to really answer this question.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Now, I know stem cell transplant are considered part of a backbone therapy, and when you hear about backbone, you think, well, an IMID like Revlimid or lenalidomide, or you think of proteasome inhibitors, the Velcade, carfilzomib. Do you see those backbone therapies changing over time with all the advent of the newer drugs?
Yeah, so I think that's a super question, Jenny. I mean, you know the history in myeloma as we start traditionally with novel agents, primarily in patients with relapsed refractory myeloma, often multiply relapsed. So it's very tough for agents to show efficacy in patients whose myeloma is very resistant. Nonetheless, that has been done many times. We mentioned 16 approvals in 12 years. But what then rapidly ensues thereafter is to move those active agents in the far advanced patients into the earlier disease course, relapse and ultimately newly diagnosed, and nowadays even into the smoldering multiple myeloma area. In any event, there are backbones, as to use your word, and what the American Society of Hematology showed in a randomized trial this year was that lenalidomide, an immunomodulatory drug, and bortezomib, a proteasome inhibitor, and steroids, is better than lenalidomide and dexamethasone for initial treatment. Many of us around the world have really purported that triplets, three drug classes, are the standard of care, and I think that's true. So a backbone for initial treatment would be an immunomodulatory drug, proteasome inhibitor, and steroid. The original proteasome inhibitor was bortezomib, but as you all know, there were two new proteasome inhibitors, carfilzomib or Kyprolis, or ixazomib, and the other word name for that is Ninlaro. But both of them are now FDA-approved in relapsed myeloma, together with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. Right now, that's being used in the relapsed setting. Over time, and already clinical trials are testing this, they may very well move up into the front newly diagnosed setting as well, just as occurred with bortezomib. For right now, though, I think one would say for practice that lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone would be a common first, if you want, backbone. In the relapse setting, carfilzomib, Ninlaro, pomalidomide on the immunomodulatory drug would be standard relapse treatments. And then after that, the antibodies probably will come into play because so far, at least, they have been approved in relapsed myeloma, especially daratumumab in the multiply relapsed myeloma. But I would expect, to answer your question directly, that the platforms will change over time. That's a good thing. That reflects progress. and we will not only have more active drugs used earlier, but my sincerest hope is we're going to have oral and well-tolerated drugs. That, to me, is the future. And I think the oral proteasome inhibitor now, together with an oral immunomodulatory drug, steroids maybe or maybe not, but all oral treatment is quite exciting for us as caregivers, but really quite exciting for patients because it makes it so much more user-friendly. So yes, the backbones are going to change and they're going to improve for sure.
And all oral just means less time in the clinic, which is just a great thing all the time.
Absolutely.
It sounded like adding in a fourth, like adding, you talk about triple combinations, and that's very common and becoming, I see a lot of papers on the triple combinations, and adding a fourth, like a monoclonal antibody, is pretty easy because you're not seeing more toxic effects in adding that fourth. I just would love to get to the day where you're taking Dex out of that triple combination and replacing it with a vaccine or something.
Yep. Yeah, I think those days are coming. Let's see with time. That's going to have to be done carefully, and it will be obviously data-driven. We certainly don't want to sacrifice efficacy. But what I would say, just to highlight what you did, you know, the least favorite medicine for our patients is high-dose dexamethasone. So yeah. If we could come up with steroid-free regimens, I think the patients, and even more importantly, probably their families would be happier. So I do think that, these templates are going to change over time. Antibodies are going to be added, immune approaches. I personally think that HDAC inhibitors, there's some more tolerated HDAC inhibitors that look very promising now. So we have new classes of drugs that are often oral that will probably make their way into the team here.
Well, great. We look forward to the day when immunotherapies are replacing Dex, because I know they suppress the immune system, so maybe just you get a double whammy or something by doing that. Now, we have a Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative, and we're trying to crowdfund for two immunotherapy projects, one's in Würzburg, Germany, and the other at your alma mater, Johns Hopkins. And I know there are others. You gave us a very nice overview of the immunotherapies at the beginning of the show. If you had to evaluate the different kinds of immunotherapies, and you mentioned checkpoint inhibitors specifically, what is most exciting to you? What do you think is coming closest to the clinic or fastest to the clinic and the most effective out of all of those?
Well, I think they're all, I think as I mentioned a little earlier, and I won't go through all of that again, because especially in the interest of time, but I think the idea of immune therapies is already in the clinic in myeloma. Lenalidomide, pomalidomide are immunomodulatory drugs. They're here. Monoclonal antibodies, daratumumab, elotuzumab, immunologic treatments already here. The checkpoint inhibitors are not approved in myeloma, but they're in clinical trials and looking promising, as I mentioned, at the American Society of Hematology, combined with immunomodulatory drugs right now. The Johns Hopkins group, Ivan Borrello, has a very exciting vaccine program in myeloma. We also have a very exciting program here with my colleague Dr. Nikhil Munshi and David Avagan. And in both of those cases and others in Israel and in Europe, the vaccines have been shown to be able to get an immune response. But as I mentioned earlier, the real excitement is that you can amplify that immune response by combinations with a checkpoint or combinations with lenalidomide and maybe even convert it to a memory response. So those things are happening. The other exciting thing are these CAR T cells that I mentioned earlier. Even though it's very early days, very impressive responses are being achieved. So I don't. It's hard to pick out which one of these is going to be the best. I really think that it's going to be a combination. Get an immune response with a vaccine or use a monoclonal antibody to target the myeloma. And in either case, then turn up or amplify the immune response with lenalidomide and or a checkpoint inhibitor. The CAR T cells work acutely, but you want to be able to maintain some level of T-cell immunity. Maybe checkpoint inhibitors and lenalidomide will help there. So it's not going to be just one modality, Jenny, is what I'm trying to say. It's going to be combinations, I think, that ultimately win the day.
Yeah, there's no one silver bullet, it sounds like.
Right.
Well, I have so many other questions. I know we're getting close to the end of show time, so I'm going to try to be efficient with my questions. So I know you have been working on a vaccine, Oncopath. Is there something you want to share about that?
I'll just mention that, and it's again against these fingerprint proteins that are on myeloma cells. And the excitement is that very quickly is you can vaccinate patients with smoldering myeloma, and you can show you can get an immune response against their own cancer cells. You can then vaccinate patients with the same vaccine, but this time with Revlimid also. And not surprisingly, you get more of an immune response. Where we are right now is we're about to begin the same vaccine with Revlimid plus a checkpoint inhibitor. And the reason I am so excited about that is that in our preclinical studies in the laboratory, if you stimulate patients' own T cells against their own myeloma in the presence of Revlimid and in the presence of a checkpoint inhibitor, you get what's called a memory immune response, both a central and an effector immune response. In plain English, when you get vaccinated against tetanus or smallpox, you get a memory immune response. So if you ever get exposed to tetanus or smallpox later, you don't get them, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you could get with a vaccine plus IMIDs plus checkpoint inhibitors or maybe some other strategy, but if you could get a memory immune response in patients against their own cancer, that's huge. And if you could do it in smoldering myeloma, one of my dreams forever has been maybe patients will never get active myeloma. Wouldn't that be a happy day?
Yeah, amazing.
So that is really exciting. Yeah.
Totally amazing. Now, earlier in the show, you mentioned the importance of genomics, and I know you've done quite a bit trying to segment patients out or understand the genetics behind so you know how to treat. Do you think that it needs to be better defined so we can start treating patients personally? I know all doctors will say they want to treat patients personally and try to the best of their ability, but especially for high-risk disease, what are you finding that's coming next?
Yeah, I think these are super questions. So I think it's not easy to talk about in a short period of time. But myeloma.
I'll take your time. Okay.
Right. No, I know. But up to it could be days here. but myeloma genomics is very complicated, as I mentioned before. I already mentioned the COMPASS trial by the MMRF&C. And other large studies, our big transplant trials, et cetera, here have all had much fancy and deep sequencing and other genomic tests done. And as I mentioned earlier, it's very heterogeneous disease, and the more in depth you look, the more abnormalities you find, and then they keep changing. So the concept of precision medicine, or treating personalized medicine, is a very attractive one. My caveat was that we're going to have put together all of our data. It's called big data, from all around the world, regardless of the source, academia, the foundations, the industry, whoever has the data. We're going to need to pool it and see if we can try to make some sense out of it. What I would say is that I personally believe it's going to help to get this data put together, primarily to identify those circuits that are wrong in myeloma. What I mean by that is, what are the circuits that cause it to grow, resist drugs, survive, migrate, etc. There may be multiple abnormalities in a given circuit, but if you can define these networks that are responsible for the abnormal behavior of myeloma, we can then interrupt those circuits. But I think it's going to be quite more complicated than we ever anticipated. It's exciting. We and others are very excited to help as much as we can push this forward. I do think it's a daunting task, and it does tell you the importance of detecting cancer as early as possible, before genomic evolution has occurred. And on the second, it really highlights the importance of using medicines as early as you can to treat the abnormalities that are there, but try to anticipate those that might be used later. The other quick point I'll mention about the genomics is, in myeloma, there are not only a lot of abnormalities, there's at least 3 to 5 different clones or abnormal family members of the myeloma right from the diagnosis. So what can happen over time is one or more of those clones can become predominant, can sort of act out and be the drug-resistant clone. Or, in fact, new clones can emerge. So, you know, it's really, we and others are trying to understand what is the fundamental hallmark abnormality that accounts for all of this gene instability. We've just finished writing a big grant with Dr. Munshi about this. Can't there be some common abnormalities that we find that is fueling this continuous genomic instability? Because if we could target the fundamental problem, then we could maybe stop this evolution from occurring. Precision medicine, just in summary, is a wonderful goal. President Obama, the Vice President Biden, the National Cancer Institute, and others are very generously supporting and really increasing funding for these efforts, and you'll see a lot of efforts made in this direction. But I do think we have to be careful and not have expectations too high, because it's a very complicated and daunting problem.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And with what should patients know about their genomics, and I guess which tests do you recommend that they have performed?
Well, right now, I don't think there is. I think that patients should participate in protocols, and many, many protocols are incorporating genomic analysis at our institution. Pretty much genomic analysis is done on all the patients that come as new patients. Right now, the number of times that it makes a difference in the way people are treated is very few. But the way we will learn over time how it might make a difference is from having this screening done, this genomic analysis done, and then correlating it with response to this treatment or that treatment. What's the outcome? Did this person respond? Did this person not respond? Etc. So I think the way to make sense of this is to participate in protocols if you have a chance to have the genomics performed. I don't think in the majority of cases that right now the genomic analysis is going to make a difference in your primary treatment today. I want to mention one quick word. You mentioned high-risk myeloma a minute ago, And everybody knows that high-risk myeloma has traditionally, for example, one characteristic would be the 17p deletion, chromosome 17p deletion. And that has been high-risk. Patients respond, but the response doesn't last very long. I mention this because the new treatments, pomalidomide, the monoclonal antibodies, daratumumab and elotuzumab, seem to work in 17p deleted multiple myeloma. My point in stating this is that high-risk myeloma is being redefined as we're here on the phone because the medicines work when no other medicines worked before. So it's only common sense that what was high-risk myeloma before is not high-risk myeloma anymore. So we're going to, and that's a good thing.
So, great thing.
Another example of the value of the profiling of patients is to understand in 2016 what really is high-risk myeloma given all the different medicines we have today.
Oh, that's so interesting. And I'm a huge advocate for patients knowing what they have because, you know, I attended a patient conference and this was a few years ago, but only about 10% of patients knew. And sometimes you can lose that feature after you've been treated. So you may not know what you're dealing with if you don't get it done early. Well, I have one last question for you before I open it up to some caller questions, and I'm hopeful that you'll just stay with us for a few minutes. What are you finding significant enough to work on next?
Well, as I said, we are quite active in what I call bench to bedside research. We have in the clinical trials, we have about 25 to maybe 30 trials open here at any one time, and they're about new targeted treatments, they're about immune treatments, they're stem cell transplant kinds of treatments, or they're supportive therapies, helping patients with bone disease and other things. So those are four categories of clinical trials. In the laboratory, we have we've just talked about it, but we and others have huge efforts in genomics. We similarly have an effort in immune treatments. We have a large effort in targeted therapies, defining new circuits that cause myeloma to grow and survive and resist drugs. And we're very excited about, if you will, blowing the fuse or interrupting those circuits at more than one place, because we think it's very important. There's a like a loop, an abnormal circuit, and oftentimes we're finding in our research that you have to block more than one spot to really make a difference. And then finally, there's a whole field called epigenetics, which is to understand, if you will, how actual ultimately gene gene and the expression of genes are actually controlled. And so to put that in plain English, we're going back further and further to understand, again, fundamental abnormalities that may account. Not only, for example, finding that there's a gene that's overexpressed in myeloma, like this c-MYC I mentioned earlier, but how come it's overexpressed? Is there something wrong in its regulation? So those would be the major areas. I do think, and I'll just say quickly in closing, but to me, myeloma has a bunch of Achilles heels. They have some weaknesses, and we've already together exploited them, and we will exploit them in the future. One I haven't mentioned, but proteasome inhibitor, Velcade, carfilzomib, now exazomib, how do they work? They block the ability of myeloma cells to deal with all this protein that they're making. Literally, the myeloma cells fill up and commit suicide because of all this protein. That's turning the myeloma cell against itself. A second Achilles heel is this immune suppression, and I've described five different ways where we're trying to overcome the immune suppression. And then finally, in the area of genomics, what I was trying to get across is that it's complicated, but as a result of all of the abnormalities in the genes, there are vulnerabilities. The myeloma cell is stressed because it's growing so rapidly. So let's make it impossible for them to deal with the stress. Or if there's so much gene abnormality, why is it that the cell doesn't die like it should? Let's figure that out and let that natural death occur. So I call them Achilles heels, but it's really, let's find out what's wrong in the biology and let's really exploit it. And I think that's really coming. So I honestly, just in closing, I think it's a hugely exciting time. I want to very much thank you for doing this, because I think in the area of such progress, the only way for patients to keep up, in my view, is to have venues like this where they can really hear up-to-date information long before they might hear it or it might be published in some other way. So a hearty thank you for all that you do.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's a privilege to talk to people directly and understand exactly what they're working on. It's just completely fascinating, and it doesn't sound like you're going to be taking a vacation anytime soon.
Well, that's probably right.
So I would like to open it up just for a few minutes if you have time for some caller questions. So if you have a question for Dr. Anderson, if you could call 347-637-2631 and press 1 on your keypad. Okay, our first caller at 889-4902. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, hi, Dr. Anderson. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know how you manage to balance new options that may not be proven yet with existing options that may be proven to be effective without the multi-year data to draw from when you suggest something new over something older.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. We would, I would encourage you. You know, we have a standard of standards of treatment, and what I mean by that is, and Jenny mentioned it earlier. So, if you will, platform of three medicines, for example, RVD for initial treatment. Those to me remain the standard of care, and so I think we are blessed with such standards of care because they work very effectively, and often novel drugs would be used, as I mentioned earlier, in patients whose myeloma has returned, so-called relapsed or even relapsed refractory. In randomized trials, the new agent is either compared or added to an already effective regimen compared against an already FDA-approved regimen. So I think the issue is, for caregivers and patients alike, you don't want to go on a medicine that isn't proven when you know there are already hugely effective proven medications. So I think that... you know, we do novel treatments right in newly diagnosed myeloma, for example. But what we tried to get across and what is true is that when we add new agents to the, or we try new agents in the setting of newly diagnosed myeloma, it's usually adding them to what we already know is an effective regimen. So Revlimid and dexamethasone had added Velcade. RVD is now being studied with monoclonal antibodies added. But I think you know, we're blessed because we have effective treatments. So, and we always want to do new things, but we also want to make sure that you, as a patient, get the benefit of what we already know with proven treatments and a track record of many years of success. So.
Thank you. Thanks for answering my question.
Okay, thanks for asking the question. We have another caller, 7684033. So go ahead with your question.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your work through many, many years with multiple myeloma, and also thank you for taking time out to talk with us today. We really appreciate all that you're doing. My question has to do with CAR-T therapy, and that I've seen lots that indicates that could be, you know, very beneficial and important in the future. But I have a hard time understanding from a pharmaceutical company point of view how they'd be able to scale that kind of therapy, scale that up, and essentially make money off of that, because it seems to be so individualized.
Yeah, no, I think I hear you loud and clear, and in that spirit, there may be more generally applicable ways to turn on people's cells, own immune cells, against their own myeloma. Many other ways are being tested right now. But back to your question, I do think, although the CAR T-cell concept is very labor-intensive, several of the major pharmaceuticals are already far along in doing this, really scaling up, to use your words, the cell collection, the cell genetic programming, the cell expansion, and supporting clinical protocols. There are multiple companies doing this. It's quite competitive. The CAR T cells are, the concept is has a basic component, but it's also being modified to try to improve it. And the different targets on the myeloma cell are being used as well. CD19 was one of the original ones that was used in leukemia, lymphoma, and some patients with myeloma. That's another target that we and others really like a little more because it's more selective and specific for myeloma, called BCMA. There are three centers that I know of that already have trials open for that. So you're going to see industry pick up on this. And in terms of, it's very labor-intensive, in terms of how they're going to make profit on this, I don't know, but I have no doubt that they'll figure that out. but I do think the idea of getting your own immune cells to react against your own myeloma is tremendously appealing, and this is one more way to do that. So I would very much stay tuned. Right now, it's primarily used in relapsed myeloma. It's not being used as an early treatment, but that may change with time if it becomes effective and more safe, et cetera. So.
Okay, thank you. That's
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great, thanks for your question. Okay, caller at 383-0489. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dr. Anderson. I was wondering, a lot of myeloma specialists disagree on the opinions of allogeneic transplants in treating myeloma. So I guess my question is, do you do them at Dana-Farber? And, you know, when is it that you recommend them if you do? I know some places, when they have their younger patients, they really start pushing those allogeneic transplants in hopes to, you know, actually cure.
Yeah, no, it's a super question. The answer really is that there's no question that allogeneic transplant can really work in myeloma. I mentioned that I had a patient since 1983 in complete response, and that's somebody who had an allogeneic transplant. So when it works, it can really work. The problem is that in most centers, there's still, in my opinion and most people's opinion, sort of an unacceptably, at least for a newly diagnosed patient, risk. It's about a 10 to 20%, but at least 10% mortality, chance of dying related to the procedure. And frankly, in today's world, where we have such novel agents, it's not usually used early because we have things that can have patients living many years without it. Having said that, there are protocols at our center and many around the country. Seattle is a huge place, and Memorial Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, and others, and this our center too, where there's efforts to, in protocols, exploit this donor of the marrow immune effect. It's called the graft versus myeloma immune effect, while avoiding the attendant side effects, graft versus host disease and others. So we have protocols. So to answer your question directly, it's usually in patients who have relapsed myeloma, and it's often been in the setting of high-risk myeloma. I do think it's getting safer to do it, and, you know, we may see things in the future. The previous caller asked about CAR T-cells. Well, maybe there'll be CAR T-cells that are allogeneic CAR T-cells someday. So I think it's a very rapidly and an exciting evolving area. The time we use allogeneic transplant right now is primarily in the context of relapse disease, and it's usually in a clinical protocol so we can try to enhance the efficacy and also improve the safety.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for your question. Okay, we'll take one more question, 949-5572.
Hey, Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for taking your time and being on the show. It's been a pleasure listening to you. And my question has to do with the complexity of treatment with all the new treatments that are on the market. I'm counting 7 new treatments in the last 12 months, new approved drugs. How do the general oncologists know how to treat this disease, let alone this, the specialists, let alone the general oncologists treat the disease with the complexity of all the potential combination therapies that are out there right now? How do you deal with that? Because it's, there's a tidal wave of new information now, and where's the training coming from, or how do these practitioners know what to do?
Well, I think it's a super question. We have, as a community of caregivers, we have our national meetings, American Society of Hematology. Otherwise, we have foundations, the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, International Myeloma Foundation, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, and others that have education for caregivers. And we have a variety of other ways. I would just say, I think that this is the, honestly, happiest problem in my lifetime, anyway, that we actually have so many options now. It turns out that when you just sit down one-on-one with a patient and you look at the different options, there are some standard things such as RVD for initial treatment. Some of the drugs right now are most commonly used in relapse, Ninlaro, carfilzomib, pomalidomide, and the antibodies, which are new kids on the block, are usually used after that. It's a moving target, but these things allow us to have effective therapies for almost everybody. Somebody comes in nowadays, for example, with a neuropathy. We now have proteasome inhibitors that can be used to help them. We didn't used to have that. We have now, for patients who find it difficult to get into the medical center, we now have an oral treatment, lenalidomide, Ninlaro, steroids.
I wish we would have had that a few years ago. We were traveling from Mexico to the United States to get the infusion, and it was very expensive.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is, I think, so just to quickly sort of summarize this, I think it's, you might say it's too complicated, et cetera, but it really is not. I'm part of something called the National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network, where we design these algorithms that lay out the different options to treat patients with newly diagnosed relapse, relapse refractory, maintenance, myeloma treatments. Those can serve as a framework both for treatment but also guarantee access to those of you who are patients to these medicines, which is really important. But it's the importance of having a myeloma expert on your team, because it is hard to keep up. You can have a local oncologist, but I would strongly recommend to have somebody who is doing myeloma to express an opinion and help guide your care over time as well.
Well, yeah, the data shows that you live years longer with a specialist on your team. Where could we get access to that framework that you're talking about, of those treatment paths? How is that available?
There's a website. I think it would be NCCN.org, www.nccn.org. that's just one of the sets of guidelines. But I mentioned that one, and Jenny, I think you must know it well. But it is very current because it makes evidence-based options available. It's not going to tell how an individual patient should be treated, but for newly diagnosed patients, it lists the options and in various categories that are appropriate to use. And so, for example, we had 7 new treatments approved last year in myeloma. Those new treatments are already in the guidelines right away. We already did that. And that's a good thing for caregivers because they can see that in the guidelines. It's a good thing for you who are patients because many of the third-party payers, including CMS, our government, use those guidelines to reimburse. So we need to make sure if we have new medicines, we can, you know, let you who are patients have access to these drugs. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Thank you so much. And I had one quick write-in question. Her name is Gratia, and she read a book by the former director of the NCI who was concerned that the FDA kind of had more oversight than it should about that its primary job was to assure the safety of new drugs, and that he was concerned that it was regulating the research and practice of oncology. I know you're involved in the NCI and wondered if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, no, I want to be a cheerleader and pay high compliments to the FDA. There is no question that there would not be 16 FDA-approved drugs in the last 12 years or 7 new drugs or new treatments approved last year if it were not for the absolute commitment and proactive patient care that is the focus of the FDA in blood cancers and particularly in myeloma. In my view, the FDA is the unsung hero. So I think there may have been problems in the distant past, but I can assure you in the last 15 to 20 years, the FDA is absolutely on your side. They are very aware of myeloma. They help to design the trials so that they can be done as quickly as possible. They are innovative. Now that we have so many medicines, the ways the trials are done in order to prove efficacy and safety have evolved over time. But I do want to really shout out, these are the unsung heroes, those folks that work for the FDA in terms of making sure. There's just an astronomical number of cancer drugs that have been approved in the last year. And many, many patients are benefiting as a result.
Well, and this year was a series of FDA priority reviews, it seems, that things were really being fast-tracked, in my opinion.
Yep. No, yeah. It's absolutely it's a happiest time of all, but it's sort of a call to action for all of us, too. So.
Well, Dr. Anderson, we've kept you way over our time, but I just want to express my appreciation for all you do for myeloma patients every day, for the amazing career that you've had treating patients and doing research on all these different aspects to help provide better therapies and treatments for us. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and best of luck to all of you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to Myeloma Crowd Radio. We know that patients can help support the discovery of a cure, and we encourage you to become involved.